Right, thank you all for coming during the lunch hour. These are the wicked hours, as I call them at the conference. All right. I'm at the University of New Mexico. I'm in the Department of Geography, and I'm also a senior fellow with the Robert Wood Johnson Center for Health Policy. There's probably a few words in the title that you may not have heard of. So one of my jobs as a geographer is to explain what I do. All right, so we'll start there, and then we'll get into actual research results. First of all, I have no relationships to disclose. However, I have something much more important to disclose. You're going to love it. That's where I live. Okay? I'm a geographer, after all. If you ask me where I live, this is what you'll get. Think about that for a second. If I give you these numbers and you do not know who I am, what do you think you can find out about me?
I go to GIS.
Go to GIS, always a good thing. And then what?
GPS.
Well, this is, you know, you can plot this into your GPS and tell me, drive to Paul's house. Right? Now, in the absence of physical field work, we're lazy, right? So we're going to sit on our computer and we're just going to do a bunch of data mining. And in about 20 minutes, you will find out, you know, the city that I live in, Rio Rancho. You will find out the neighborhood that I live in, Cabazon, you know, suburbia. You will get a picture of my house. You'll quickly find out that I live in a one-story, three-bedroom house that's worth $156,000. And I have a white Kia Optima in my driveway. That took you all of like 3 minutes, right? And you've never done this before. You're not a geographer. You're not trained in this. But you can do this easily, right? What else do you think you can find out? Can you think you can actually find out the address without going to my house? Sure. Just pop in a little button on the tool. That's my address. Okay? Now, once you have my address, you're like, it's a gold mine. Can you find out my last name?
Yes.
Whether I own my house?
Yes.
Whether I vote it?
Yes.
How much
I paid for the house? I mean, it's incredible.
Your horoscope.
and worse. So, the point is, publishing a location is like giving away your life as an open book, all right? So location privacy is the issue of what information do we make available through location, all right? So I work on location privacy, among other things. And the key is we shouldn't be publishing these maps, right? This is a good example of a published research where they reverse engineered the locations of dead bodies after Katrina. Front page of the newspaper, right? And the topic aside, it's well established that if we publish these maps, we can pretty much find out where it was in the field and the identity of the individuals. So these maps shouldn't be published. And just a little bit of terminology to go with that. Obviously, we create these locations with geocoding. You've probably heard of that term. Put in the address, the points come out in a JS environment. We could easily put this in reverse, and that's called reverse geocoding. And that's what hackers use. That's what I use for my research. So it's easy. A regular GIS software has it, Google Maps has it, Bing has it. It's a built-in technique. So publish the map, and you might get into trouble. Because you can overlay it with parcel data and voting records, and the databases just keep on merging together, and it's going to cause a lot of privacy concerns if you publish the maps of, say, patients or any other group that is sensitive, that you want to keep confidential. So the question becomes to publish or not to publish your geographic information. And there are plenty of examples of people who publish it without giving it much thought. Not to name any names. But the point is, be very careful. Sort of lesson number one. All right. So what are we to do? Not publish the information? A lot to be said for geographic context of where things occur. So we do want to have that information. But what do we normally do is aggregating. So we have locations of, say, patients or a survey. We aggregate them, and we want to do that anyway to generate rates. Okay? So might as well publish the rate map, right? But we're losing something. There's something to be said for the points. They're going to give us more information than the aggregated data. So how can we publish it? Well, I grabbed the latest issue of Environmental Health Perspectives, right, that we probably all read. Sure enough, 20,000 points on a map. I almost fell off my chair. What? We're still doing this? But sure enough, they explained that they removed the location using a technique known as jittering. Okay, that's not the term I use, but it actually captures it fairly well. We shake the location so it's no longer the true location. Okay, I call that, and most geographers call that, geographic masking. Right, so jittering, geographic masking, same thing. This is sort of the term that has emerged. And so the idea is, here are the original locations, and we just move them around a little bit with some sort of an algorithm. So the blue dots are the originals, the red dots are the masked locations. We remove the originals and publish the masked locations. From a statistical perspective, the properties are similar, but we no longer disclose the actual location. Now, you may not have worked on this information, but you can already see a lot of issues here. And if you just look at the maps, it's not as easy as it looks. So my research is partly to figure out how these masking techniques work, which one works best given the context of your analysis. So we're interested in how much privacy protection these masking techniques provide, and we'll cover which ones in a little bit. Find out how dependent that is on the parameters of the specific algorithm, the population density, and any other information that goes with it, the context of the map. And finally, once we've masked it, does it still have any properties left that are useful to us? If we basically move the location so far that it's a totally different map, why bother with publishing that map? Right? So there's sort of a trade-off. Okay, just to introduce sort of the broader concept of confidentiality and anonymity, a concept that I found very useful for my research is the K-anonymity concept. Essentially, there is a data set, and you know you cannot publish this. You cannot publish the name and the address, so you say, I remove that from the data set, but keep everything else, and I put it online. Anybody see a problem here?
In a sparsely populated community, this could identify an individual.
That's right. And it's easier than you think. Put up the voting records. Like, it's really that. Soft match the data. How many people in the same zip code have the same birth date? I mean, come on. Right? It's almost like duh. So the idea is the K-anonymity concept allows you to test your data for confidentiality rules. There's no magical value for K, but typically people say 20, 50, or 100, depending on your context. So you start eliminating variables like the birth date. How many people live in the same zip code of the same gender? Okay, well, my K is probably 1,000, right? But is it 1,000 everywhere? And how do you test for this? So this has been fairly well established for things like medical records, and it's although not always explicit, it's implicitly assumed we use these techniques. How does this work for geographical data? What's spatial K-anonymity? Right? So that's partly what I'll explain in my research. All right, so let's go through the methodology. We start off with a sample, and we do this for maybe a dozen or so counties. I'm just going to show you one as a flavor of the results. We start off with all possible residential addresses, the actual house. Like I have a drawing of their house, 2 out of 1,000 of them. Okay? We create a artificial cluster, so we introduce properties that we're going to test for later to see if they're maintained. So we do a base sample rate of 0.5%, and we oversample in some selected areas based on density, and we come up with a sample of maybe 1,000 or so. Depends a bit on the study area. So we have what you might consider sort of a fairly common event, but it's not, you know, that common. So the base rate is about 0.5%. So we have our sample, and then we apply a masking techniques. It's impossible to see at this scale, but if you zoom in, they're just swapped with another location somewhere nearby. And then we run a test for spatial K-anonymity. And I'll show you that algorithm in just a minute. All right? So we test for how much privacy does it provide. Then we run some statistical test. So we might run a cluster technique of some sort. Right? And I'll show you the different cluster techniques we show. This particular example, we've masked it, and the clusters are similar but not identical. So we can quantify the degree of sort of error introduced through our masks. We do a comparison, so how robust is our analysis after the masking? Do we get the same results, approximately? And then what's the trade-off? If we increase the amount of privacy protection, are we losing spatial analysis robustness? And the answer is yes, but exactly how does that occur? And are there techniques that do this better than others? So the basic concept here is that we we introduce a certain amount of data manipulation, so we move the points further away, if you will, and that increases the amount of privacy protection that it provides. Our value for K is going to go up. At the same time, the usefulness, in other words, the information we can derive statistically from that data set is going to go down. But these are conceptual curves. What do they really look like? Do they look like this or that? That's sort of important to know. So sort of the longer-term objective of this research is to construct these curves for specific algorithms so we know what we're dealing with, and we can decide whether we want to use geographic masking or not, given how it performs on a particular type of data. Okay. This entire methodology we do for a lot of different study areas for several different techniques. So we've developed this as a toolbox. So we're about halfway through our project. We've got most of the methods up and running. Now we're going to run extended simulations. So we automated the technique. We wrote some code in ArcGIS. So it's now a set of tools. If you use GIS, these tools look just like the one the software company made. So they're easy to use. But it helps our analysis, obviously. Okay? And that allows us to get results pretty quickly. So which masking techniques? We're not going to cover all of these in detail, but essentially you move it a certain distance, and you can either use a fixed distance or a random distance or constrain it in some way. So the first one is the simplest one. Just place it anywhere on a circle. The second one is place it anywhere within that circle. And then we can enforce a minimum displacement, which we call donut masking. And rather than a uniform distribution, we can assume a Gaussian, a normal distribution in various ways. And at the bottom, we have two other techniques that we're developing, which is not placing in a random location, but place it in one of several possible locations. So we don't displace a point like inside a lake. Some of these have been published already. A couple of these are new. And we're just, quite frankly, comparing everything that we know is out there, seeing which one is going to stand up the best to our analysis. I will not show results for all of these. It just gets a little daunting. I just want you to get a good flavor of how we analyze it. All right. You can imagine that if you displace a location in an urban area by, say, 100 meters, you're probably a few houses down the street. However, what if you displace by 100 meters in a rural area? You may not be off the property, right? So the idea is we need to look at population density and change our masking techniques with the population density. That's just sort of logic. And so the general formula that's been proposed for this is 1 over the square root of population density. It seems to work. I'm not convinced it's the only technique we should be looking at. But as an example, if we're going to go with a base of 100 in an urban area, which gets you maybe a few apartment complexes down the street, you have to basically, to accomplish a similar level of privacy protection, you need to move it at least 4 times as much, approximately. And we can test if this is good enough, and we're working on different scaling formulas. All right. How do we measure spatial K anonymity? So we apply the masking techniques. How do we figure out the privacy protection provided? So we've come up with what's really a simple technique, but it seems to be effective. Let's take the original location. We displace it by a certain distance, and we have a masked location. What if we publish the masked location and somebody were to go and look back at where the original might have been? They're going to have a sort of a circular search radius going out. So how many houses are they going to encounter before they get to the one I was trying to protect? That's sort of the logic. All right. So they may not know how far it was displaced, but the logic is, closer to the masked location is more likely. So we put on a circle of the same radius, and then we identify all the houses within that circle, and that becomes our value of K. Right? Now, a hacker may not know what that radius is, but this is sort of one way to measure, how many potential candidates would they encounter before they get to the wrong one. Right? It's a simple technique, but it seems to be effective in comparing our results. I'll show some results for these three particular techniques, just to give you a flavor, and you'll notice that the first one has a fixed displacement, the second one has a random displacement, and the third one has a random displacement, but it has a minimum enforced to it. So it's always at least a certain amount of meters away from the original, which turns out to be a good thing, as you could probably imagine just sort of conceptually. All right, so what do? We generate a K anonymity value for every single masked location. So we have about 1,000 or so. We calculate the value of K interactively for each location. we plot the value of k, and then we plot the cumulative percentage. All right, so this is a bimodal Gaussian displacement. It's uniform, so not accounting for population density. And if you only displace the house by 20, as you can see, almost no one is safe. Most people are, the mass location is still the closest one to them. Their value for k is like zero. Thank you. So a small displacement is not going to work. So we increase the displacement, and the curve starts to shift. That's what we want. In fact, how do we want this curve to look like? Can you visualize what we want it to look like? I mean, we want k to be less than 20 or 50 for nobody. So the curve, we want it to look like this. And then it can go up whatever way we want. Right? So that's our goal. And apparently, cranking up that distance, which starts to reduce our robustness, is not the way to go. Just cranking it up doesn't work. So one of the big results here is the uniform distances are not going to work. We need to apply a scale distance. So this curve comes down more quickly, especially for rural areas of low density. All right, so scaling is definitely something we have to do. I'll show you another curve just like it. And here are the values for K20 and K50 showing that we want those intersections to be the lowest possible. So we go to a second approach, which is a scaled approach, 200 in the high density areas up to 800 in the low density areas, comparing those three different techniques. And sure enough, they're a little closer to what we want. Right? They're not quite there. It also shows that the best performing ones, the bimodal Gaussian and the random direction fixed radius, enforce at least a minimum displacement, and that seems to work best. That sort of makes conceptual sense, and statistically it comes out. So the Gaussian approach, widely used, definitely worse. So I think we have a metric here that allows us to test for the performance of various techniques. Okay, again here, the intersections, and again, we're not quite there. We want this to be even lower, okay? But we can now test and compare the different approaches. I'll just flag a few other results. And of course, we have this for all the techniques, for all kinds of different parameters, but the tables get very large. I'll just flag a couple of things. The big issue is the masking parameters matter dramatically. If you mask by about 50 meters, you're not getting any protection. You have to go at least to 100 or typically 200 for it to really make a difference. So anything less than about 200, probably not enough. Okay? So the parameter matters greatly. All right? Secondly, the methods are not the same. So using the same distances, look at what differences we get in our values of k. For the Gaussian displacement, it's much, much worse. Okay? We see that in the curves, and we see that in specific cutoffs, which we might use as our guiding principles for minimum performance standards. All right. How does masking affect the actual statistical properties? So we have a long list of techniques, and you've got another hour, right? You're not going anywhere. I'm just getting started. All right. Okay. I got it. I'm only going to do two. So we're going to do an aggregated data and a point data analysis, right? It's going to vary. So we'll look at local Lorenz I first. It's a local indicator of spatial association. We aggregate the data, calculate rates, and then we compare whether the clusters are the same, right? So it's by census tract. So in this particular case, this is a different county. We have three clusters. The colors represent the population category. We know where they are because we introduced them, and sure enough, they come out. All right, then we look at the effect of those the boundaries of those clusters under different scenarios. So as we go to the right, we see different techniques displaced. It turns out that it varies by population density, and it varies by masking techniques. And it's not always easy to predict what happens. There's a certain amount of random noise occurring. If you look at the value for k, though, it's a pretty clear which one you would pick. I mean, the random direction fixed radius, the clusters are, in fact, perfect. And the protection value of k is the highest. So again, I think we're onto an analysis methodology that will allow us to pick the better technique based on a specific data set. Second technique I'll show is kernel density. In fact, we use a dual kernel density. Kernel density is basically counts per square kilometer. We do this for the sample. We do this for all the residential addresses. Look at the ratio so we get our clusters back. Okay? And then we look at the boundaries, whether those clusters have shift in space because the points have been shifted. Here's one example of a low population density cluster. Cluster's pretty robust for low amounts of displacement. By the time we get to much higher level of displacements, the maps look cool, but the boundaries are totally wacko. It does matter. You cannot keep increasing these masking parameters and expect the data to perform well. I'm almost there. And again, the values of k that we want actually make it very troublesome to get the boundary we need. So there's definitely a trade-off for these much more sensitive parameters. In a high-density area, the cluster is much more robust just because of sample size. You know, moving a couple of points, it doesn't seem to make a big difference. So it's very dependent on population density. All right. So, conclusions. As far as geographic masking, the technique matters a lot. Just calling it jittering doesn't tell us if it was an appropriate technique. Secondly, scaling is absolutely required to get protection of confidentiality across different population density categories, and a minimum enforcement is definitely recommended. I think the approach we have for spatial k-anonymity works. It's not perfect, it's simple, but it seems to allow us to tell the differences between different techniques. As far as clustering methods, by the time we aggregate, data appears to be very robust. We can mask by 200-300 meters, and the results are not very sensitive. Point-based analysis, like kernel density, is very sensitive. So we do look at a substantial amount of error there. Where's this heading? Obviously, we have more work to do. We want to come up with more refined techniques to compare across a lot of different parameters. We'll make the tool available. It works for us, but it's not quite usable for others yet. We will make these sets of tools available on our website. We're also interested in the reverse engineering of the masking technique. If you tell me what you use to mask, can I put that in reverse and move the location back to where it came from? It's on a circle. You moved it by 100 meters. You know where to look. You just put the circle in reverse, right? So it's tricky. The ones that perform best in one approach may not always be the recommended one. And what if you have a data set where you can generate multiple disclosures? You can imagine a server generating these for us. And what if you hack in 10 different times and you get 10 different disclosures? All these techniques are symmetrical. So by the time you have 10 masked data sets, you can probably pinpoint what the average is supposed to be. So there's more issues to deal with. So stay posted on what's happening. I want to recognize my funding agencies, the National Science Foundation, NIH, and the Robert Wood Johnson Center. And my presentation is already posted on my website. So if you want to look at this again over lunch, feel free to do so. All right. With that, I thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mrs. Zandri. We've got time left. So
like
if
an
people,
hour for questions.
Yeah, exactly. We've got lots of time for questions. So if there's questions, please.
That's right.
You protect her anonymity, but you mask, and my point comes up. So you protected her kind of at my expense.
That's
the
right.
The hacker, the CIA guy, or whoever's looking for her now comes knocking on my door. So it's not the right door. Yeah, but now I've got to deal with a CIA.
That's right, and it is an issue. And so, I mean, if you were to publish a map and you say in big, bold letters, these are not the actual locations, legally you're sort of off the hook. Ethically, depending on the context, you may not be. And so I'm not suggesting that all data sets could be made sort of, you know, protected using masking. So there's probably conditions where masking is not going to do you any good. You should not publish the data, period. But there is a great interest in, you know, geographically tagging everything that we do and have, including for health purposes. So I think as long as we understand... Yes.
Solve his problem with the map, so.
And he never worried about masking.
No.
And because there was not much issues.
No HIPAA.
No HIPAA and no Google Earth. Right? And so it's hitting us very hard. I see a lot of examples of published maps that I don't think should have been published. And so I'm trying to raise that awareness and suggest some alternatives. It doesn't mean masking is always going to be the right or the best choice. and there are alternatives. And I fully agree with you. Yes?
Does Esri provide any kind of masking tool or anything?
Didn't even know what it is. But that'll change.
And so when your tool is available, we'll all be able to go and download it?
Yes.
And use it?
Definitely, yes. It's a... the Esri platform is not open source, obviously, but you can write tools that people can just plug in, if you will. And those could be, and those are open source. All my models are Python, and so they're open source. Esri is interested in it. I'm partly organizing with Esri geocoding conference in December. Not focusing on privacy, but they're obviously very interested in ethical issues related to geocoding data sets. We'll have a session on geocoding ethics as well. So they're gradually getting aware of it. But there isn't sort of an embracement of, oh, let's put masking in our software. But who knows, maybe in a couple of years, we'll have more standardized procedures. If you need a certain level of confidentiality, here's what you could use. But my tools will be available for free. Yes?
Just a clarification about some of the graphs you put up earlier.
Yes.
Which had K, I guess, on the horizontal axis.
Yes.
Frequency. On the vertical. Are those based on, on a specific location or a set of points that you simulated? Or?
Remember how we took a sample mm-hmm. of about 1,000, which has an artificial cluster built into it? Mm-hmm. And so we calculate the K value for every one of those 1,000 points. Mm-hmm. So if you look back at the methodology, as far as sort of how we do this, a lot of pages here. Here's my sample of about 1,000. I mask them a little bit, and then I know by how much I displaced them, because I designed the algorithm, I buffer those locations and then overlay that back with the original. So yes, it's the aggregate distribution of those 1,000 points. The average doesn't help. Like we don't care that there's points that have K values of over 100. We're worried about how many of them are less than 20 or 50. And so we do a continuous distribution rather than just an average, because we're really interested in the bottom part of that curve and exactly where that sits. Okay, we have 7 masking techniques. We're always looking for another one. So if you wake up tomorrow morning with a glass of orange juice and you're thinking, "Hey, why didn't he do X, Y, Z?" Let me know. Okay. Yeah.
So you've looked at the effects of masking on sort of the aggregate clustering and the point clustering.
Yes.
So have you thought about, or is it interesting to think about sort of what it might do to spatial regression models or when you estimate those? Because, so when I think about this type of masking, I think of, as an econometrician myself, like a non-classical measurement error problem, mm-hmm. especially when you make the masking, say, dependent on population density. But you get really interesting sort of non-standard measurement error. So I wonder if that's sort of something that you think is worthwhile to look at, or if that's something you're considering.
Definitely. And one thing that happens is that you may mask rural locations more, but the units of analysis are typically larger. So they sort of counterbalance. Mm-hmm. So we're actually going to do geographically weighted regression. That's what we use, rather than just linear regression, because we want to see where the coefficients change, right? If you do geographically weighted regression, you get basically a spatial, you get a map of the coefficients and the residuals. So we'll look at those. We'll see if the coefficients change, you know, if the significance of a particular regression changes locally. Like we know where the cluster is, we know what the coefficients should look like, have they actually decreased to the point where they become non-significant? So definitely spatial regression is on our list. Yes, and that may not be the only technique, but it's the one that I know best, frankly.
So when you're doing like a fixed distance technique, can you add something into your algorithm so you keep that point within a census tract, for example, or you know, your example of not putting somebody in the middle of a lake? That seems to me like it would be quite complicated, but I'm not a...
No. I mean, you know, 20 more lines of code, yeah. But conceptually, you know.
So, okay.
Yes.
So you have, you know, people at the health department.
We can keep them in the same unit.
Doing analyses. They're not geographers. They've to map foodborne disease in a county, and maybe putting dots on a map. So, you know, if they want to do something like this, but they want to keep these books in the census tract so then they can do the rates by census tract or whatever.
You want the concordance to be perfect. That's what we're testing. We're testing how big of a problem it is. And if it turns out to be a big problem, which for small areas it will be, you can write an extra...
I'm taking New Mexico then from New Mexico as well.
Yes.
And you can have a census tract with a lot of people right next to the reservation, for example.
And you don't want to move them into...
Right.
Yes, you don't want to influence the rate counts.
So I guess what I guess I'm back to the, we need your tool.
Yes.
Because I can't do it.
No. And so there are ways... Okay. And so there are definitely ways to, you know, draw that circle, but cut it off to within the area of interest. So you don't move things beyond a zip code or beyond a census tract. And we haven't done that yet, but it's one more thing on the list. It's a little bit further down the list because we have other things to get to first, but technically it's not difficult. We just want to make sure we start off with a good set of techniques first. Filter out maybe the ones that we know don't perform well in general, and then constrain them. I should say that the technique that I like best, frankly, is location swapping. In other words, I only place it on another existing house, and so it never ends up in the water, and I can reduce that sample to just the ones that are within a tract or within a zip code. And so to answer your question, if I don't do a location swapping within a donut, I can do location swapping within any other polygon that I can think of. So you only get the houses within the unit of interest. And that in itself creates issue with sample size. You know, what if there's only like 20 in a unit? There's not much to go around. But technically, it's not that hard. But thank you for the suggestion, because it's definitely something we want to work on, yes. Theoretically, yes. The kind of data sets we have, we're dealing with public data sets that are called address points and partials. And although I'm pretty good at data mining, nothing publicly available allows me to determine if it's a male or a female living in a particular house. And we can do statistical distributions about who's more likely to live there, but we don't know for every single house who lives in that household. Census data is at the block level, and so we're typically dealing at a block of maybe 20 to 50 houses. And so we can statistically distribute those individuals to individual houses, but it remains a statistical distribution, not an exact characteristic. But we can add a probability that I want the location swapping, for example, to be, you know, use a higher probability for a certain subset of my data based on demographics or based on the type of structure. Let's swap apartments for apartments. Let's swap single houses versus single-family houses. My unit of analysis are housing units, because that's what I can get my hands on. I don't use individuals. Like, I don't use real data. I make my maps that are synthetic. So there's no privacy concerns when I publish my maps. So technically, we can do it, but it's more probabilistic than sort of an exact identification of a very similar individual. Does that answer your question?
Kind of goes with my question, which you're just saying you can swap in a single family home, but can you weight it so that a double shotgun gets twice the chance than a single, a big multi unit place is gonna have?
Yeah. We can tie this to the value of the property.
Yeah.
So you can stratify by, that's probably the only thing we can get individually. Not how many people or their age or their gender, but income. You know, essentially a surrogate for income. We know for every location the value of the property and how many bedrooms and the square footage. So that could become a good surrogate for other demographics. You know, we're swapping for a similar location, but not a similar person.
Well, I'm not even talking about swapping for a similar location. Just when you're swapping, instead of all those points having an equal probability of getting swapped, the place that has 100 units in it,
okay,
versus the place that has 2, having a higher chance of getting selected to be swapped with.
Yes, we can assign probabilities, definitely. Yeah, we'll get there. but don't hold me to it for the next couple months. Was there one other question?
Yes, there was a slide you mentioned that the fixed radius results a imperfect clustering. That you showed there were high, medium, and low.
Yes.
My question is, when you say fixed radius, is the radius fixed with the density clustering, or they are fixed all across the board?
You mean the scaling?
The one that, like a panel graph that you have, or this cluster shown on like a 3x4.
Let's see here.
I think way back in the
This one here?
No. It would be like 3x4, like 12 feet with a map.
Like a, oh, okay. That one.
Yeah. So column 2, when you say fixed radius, is the radius the same in all yellow, orange, and red?
No.
They are fixed within inch.
200, 300,
800. Oh, sorry.
That one's too. Yeah, it's too small. Yeah, I know. But this sort of assumes that uniform is not really a good place to start with to begin with. So the top is actually masked by 800 meters, but because the units are quite large, it doesn't really have the effect that you would see for small units. These are not to scale. These are zoomed in. These are much smaller units. And so they are, the units are scaled inversely proportional to the population density. And because census tracts are also inversely scaled to population density. Yes, it doesn't have to be. Frankly, we could generate a distance based on the properties of individual point. I made my life a little easier with the tools to pick like three different levels. But you, for every census tract or for every location, you could say, well, what's the population density? What's the local density of points? You know, one thing that we'll probably do at some point is to make the scaling dependent on the local density of points rather than population density. Yes.
What is the new insight to that in terms of masking privacy?
Probably more problematic than the techniques that we're using. Like the aggregated data is not very sensitive because you don't care about a linear measurement from a certain locale. If you overlay this with noise data and or pollution from roads, pretty strong distance decay function, 100 or 200 meters, matters a lot. So depending on the spatial resolution of your exposure information, masking may totally destroy your exposure relationships, frankly. It's probably something we'll do at a next step. We have a proposal in to do that. If your exposure is something like broad air pollution like ozone, the spatial variability might be pretty small. But something like noise from roads or pollution, particulates from roads, very fine scale resolution, strong distance decay functions, probably masking is going to destroy your relationships. So we have to relate the masking to the spatial autocorrelation of your exposure variable. And what we hope to do with making these tools available, then you can plug in your own exposure model and test it. And you'll probably find that it's probably more problematic than the techniques that we're using, unfortunately. Okay? Well, thank you for your time. And you want to close?
Let's give another round of applause for our presenters. Thank you very much.